Welcome to this episode of Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. My name's Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Brian Kaplan, an American economist and author who I believe is currently sitting on the New York Times bestsellers list.
That is correct.
Excellent. Now, Professor Kaplan is in town to give this year's Hayek Memorial Lecture, and the IEA is really looking forward to hearing what you have to say about poverty this evening, which I hope to be able to release as a podcast on this channel, so look out for that. But this week, I'd like to talk about public choice. And we might get on to why you think public choice can actually be relevant to the poverty question. But let's see. So Professor Kaplan, you might well know that the United Kingdom is currently in a general election period.
I had heard that,
yeah.
Despite being a colonist, I'm not completely out of the loop.
Yeah. So there's been a slew of spending commitments, and politicians of all hues are talking about the good that government can do, even on the conservative side of the argument. And they're expressing the opinion that it's the job of government to identify and correct market failure. So at the expense of groups like consumers and taxpayers. But in your sobering assessment, in your 2007 book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies, you argued that the greatest obstacle, to sound economic policy is not entrenched special interests or rampant lobbying, but the popular misconceptions, irrational beliefs, and personal biases held by ordinary voters. So I'd like to start then by asking, do you think to a certain extent the myth of the rational voter is a bit of a straw man? Because has anyone ever claimed that voters are especially rational?
Actually, I would say that the usual view is that if most people think something is a good idea, it therefore is presumptively a good idea. Mm-hmm. So that's the sense in which I think that it is no myth. It is very common in politics to say the people of this country want this. Mm-hmm. And very rarely does someone then make the next sentence, what a bunch of fools. Instead, it's you are fools that would attempt to question the wisdom of the mass of the people in this country. Even though, of course, on so many other questions, it's well known that the public's views are misguided. So the germ theory is not very popular for a long time, and evolution remains unpopular in the United States. Mm-hmm. And yet, they are wrong. Mm-hmm. that is the popular view was wrong, mm-hmm, in those cases, yes.
And, I mean, do economists suffer from these biases as well that you speak of, at least to a limited extent?
Yeah, so my view is absolutely economists are human just like everybody else. I would say the typical autobiography of an economist, and I've talked to many, is that almost all economists start off as typical leftist intellectuals when they're teenagers. And then they learn some economics, and then normally what they realize is, oh, what we're asking for was excessive, there would be collateral damage, we should tone things down. And that's why the typical economist, at least in the United States, is a moderate Democrat. They still have the same values they did when they were teenagers, but at the same time, they've learned enough about scarcity and opportunity costs and incentives to realize that many of the more extreme ideas are mistaken. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say that's all the correction anyone ever needs to do. My view is that they haven't really corrected enough, and that they are clinging to misguided views and trying to water them down rather than to really do a fundamental rethinking of the worldview that they were raised in.
Mm. Now, you lay out in the book, you lay out several ways to make democratic government work better. For example, urging economic educators to focus on correcting popular misconceptions. I mean, when you have a sort of left-wing bias in things like academia, for example, mm-hmm, do you think that that's open to, abuse itself if you have people actually, mm-hmm, correcting misinterpretations, etc.?
Yes, of course, I'm only in favor of correcting misconceptions without scare quotes.
Right.
So I'm against the, quote, correcting, quote, of, quote, yeah, misconceptions,
yeah,
end,
yes,
quote.
Yeah.
Now, you know, in a way, I was writing this book partly to be read by economic educators. People already have a position to go and improve their teaching and try to urge them to actually share their knowledge with their students instead of what I think is a very misguided view of letting them work it out for themselves, which is another way of saying I'm not going to help the situation,
yeah,
because, you know, there's a reason why most people don't work this out for themselves, because the questions are very hard, mm-hmm, and the smartest people in history struggled with them. And to then say we have to go and have everyone redo the work, I mean, to me, is just such an odd view. It's like, well, there's division of labor. We've done the work. Let's share the product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Now, I mean, is the only way to educate people in the sphere of economics? And if so, does that imply that that only people with an economics degree should be allowed to vote? Is that the implication of what we're saying?
Right. I wouldn't say that's the implication. You know, there are a lot of ways that you might take it. So, you know, one, of course, is you could say the system is as fine as it is, but we should defer to economists and we should just pay more attention to what they have to say and stop acting like a person can figure out complicated questions in their spare time. So that's one approach that you might take. Mm-hmm. I've talked about giving extra votes to people that are more informed. And then, of course, there's just greater deference to experts. So, I've often told students who are planning on working for the government, well, don't be shy about trying to improve things while you're there, mm-hmm. right? If politicians give you some leeway to go and do the good thing or the bad thing, do the good thing. And if they'll let you make up your own mind without asking them, don't ask them because they'll probably tell you the wrong thing. So give them what they need rather than what they want.
So from what you're saying then, do you think these irrational preferences that you describe are hardwired? And if so, can they ever be countered?
Yes. Specifically, I'd say irrational beliefs rather than preferences.
Okay.
But so hardwired is, I think, too strong. You might say, you know, there's a natural tendency towards these kinds of mistakes. So, I mean, of course, if you just say they're hardwired and no one can ever change, then there's the possible, how are we talking about them then? But I would say that, you know, things, for example, like xenophobia, I think are very natural to humanity. I don't know of any country where people blame themselves for their problems when they have any remotely available foreign scapegoat for what's going wrong with their country. At the same time, of course, people are able to manage these. And furthermore, things like xenophobia, one of the main things that's happened is people have just redefined what counts as their countrymen or people that are in their circle of trust. So here in England, of course, if we were to go back some centuries, then the people in Wessex would have their own Wessexian identity and would be trying to blame things on people over in London. Now I assume there's not too much of that going on any longer, although maybe the Welsh will still get on your case.
If a lot of people are inherently resistant to economic reasoning, which the book does argue, what does that say about the role and purpose of an educational charity, not to put you on the spot, such as the IEA?
Mm-hmm. Well, if an educational charity can go and make a difference here, that's would be a very great thing. I mean, just to know, there is a problem, first of all. So before you start raising charitable money, you want to make sure you've correctly identified a problem. And then step two is, do you have some way of actually improving it? Now, I've done quite a bit of other work on education, making me very skeptical in general of efforts of persuasion. But the main lesson that I draw from it is not that there's no point in trying to persuade people, but it would behoove everyone involved in this, starting with me, to try to figure out better ways of communicating with people and just to become better listeners, but also to explain yourself in a way which is more easily understood by your audience.
Mm. What do you think about Jay Brennan's notion of epistocracy, as well as Brennan's argument that if you are not well-informed, I'm doing my quote thing again, sorry, if you're not well-informed and know you are not well-informed, then you've got a duty not to vote at all?
Yeah, so I have great respect for Jason Brennan's work. My main objection to epistocracy or rule by the well-informed is just that I don't see any easy way of getting from here to there or even any hard way of getting from here to there. So I think of this as sort of a catch-22 problem where I think you would need epistocracy to get epistocracy. As to how you would get otherwise, I don't know. And I don't know that he would actually disagree with that. I think that he would be more of, this is a better system that we have. And we are locked into something that is worse, but just wanted you to know that there is something better available. His argument that it is immoral to vote when you don't know what you're doing makes incredible sense to me. You talk about this as the Spider-Man principle. With great power comes great responsibility. So in the same way that if you see brain surgery going on, it would be morally wrong for you to get involved if you don't know what you're doing. Similarly, I say that it is morally wrong for a person to get involved in politics when they don't know what they're doing. My view is definitely that the person who doesn't know what's going on and abstains is morally far superior to the activist who doesn't know what they're doing. This is something where for almost anything outside of politics, it's an obvious point. So why this is even controversial, why we even encourage the ill-informed to participate is very puzzling to me. So yes.
Yeah. I mean, we saw in the United Kingdom with Britain's vote to leave the European Union that there was a lot of backlash with people saying that this was a vote by those who didn't know what they were actually voting for, etc., etc. That was a line that was repeated and has been repeated since. But then a very powerful line during that referendum was that people had had enough of experts. So do you worry that actually there's a moves against technocrats, against technocracy, or you see that with the election of Donald Trump, I think, as well, possibly?
A little bit. So first of all, I mean, I think that there are, unfortunately, many so-called experts who don't really know that much about what they're talking about either. Foreign policy experts in particular seem to be woefully unquantitative in the way that they look at the world. But I think, you know, there probably is, you know, a modest tendency in that direction. But at the same time, I don't think that there's any big change coming. So I have a slogan, which is that attention deficit disorder will save us. So one of the best things about ill-informed voters is that when they do participate, they then quickly lose interest. And so they don't actually hold the politicians' feet to the fire to make them really follow through with whatever they had to promise to do in order to get elected, which, of course, if you think that people have a great wisdom, this is terrible. But on the other hand, since I don't think that they have this great wisdom, I think this is one of the main things that protects us and buffers us from the dangers of populism, which is just that people that get emotionally worked up over issues tend to temporarily care, and then they fall back into their stupor. And so,
yeah.
So it's not, I mean, so, I mean, in a way, you know, from, you know, in my mind, you know, one of the great questions of politics is, why aren't things a lot worse? Why isn't every country like Perón's Argentina or every democracy? And my answer, you know, one part of my answer is just the public just doesn't pay that much attention. And so this leaves some wiggle room for the people in power to not do the worst possible thing.
Mm. Do you think there's a reason, the reason why your books sell so well and Open Border, it's called Open Borders, isn't it? Is selling very well is because actually people want to be better informed. You know, that the issue on immigration is raging in the United States at the minute. And do you think voters actually do want to tap into that and become better informed on the merits of immigration potentially?
So I wish that were true, but
do you think I'm naive?
Well, here's the thing is, you know, you can have a bestseller and still not be selling millions of copies.
Yeah.
So that's the truth. You don't need to sell a million copies to make the bestseller list. So I think, you know, the truth is that the people that buy my books are usually, you know, just curious, very intellectually curious people. It's not just the average American voter or the average British voter that buys my books. It's people who, if not actual wonks, are just very intellectually lively and interested in controversial ideas. And so there's enough people like that where I can sell, you know, a relatively large number of books, and yet I can't honestly say that I see my work tipping elections or anything like that. That just wouldn't be, that would just be self-delusion.
Now, I wonder if you could set out whether or not you believe that your analysis fits with public choice theory, or does it actually call that way of thinking into question?
Right. So there's two ways you could look at this. So one is you could just say public choice theory is whatever economists were saying about politics before 1980. Right. And in that case, what I'm saying is very different from what that intellectual tradition says, because those people had very little interest in public opinion and really wanted to blame political dysfunction on special interests. On the other hand, if you just say, no, public choice theory is whatever the best economics tells us about politics, then I'll say there's no conflict at all. In fact, I think that my work is a very important part of public choice theory. So, and again, you know, just to get a little background on this, so there's a long tradition in economics of saying, well, the reason why we have steel tariffs is the steel industry lobbied for them. The reason we have sugar tariffs is because the sugar industry lobbied for them. And as long as you don't know any public opinion, this is a very appealing explanation, because it is true the industries do have offices and try to persuade politicians. But then if you do, when you do learn public opinion, you find out, wow, actually the public agrees with the lobbyists. The public wants to have steel tariffs. The public wants to protect the sugar industry. Right. And so on down a very long list of topics. So while there is this perception that governments don't listen and ignore the common man, I say when you actually look at public opinion and what governments do, governments actually follow public opinion rather closely. And my story here is this is over no cause for celebration, because the public is just so often misguided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then do you think it does call the entire thinking into question then? Do you given what you've just said, they're misguided, the whole theory mm-hmm. behind it, I mean, where do you stand on that? Do you have sympathy for the public choice?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. My office is in the Center for Study of Public Choice. Yeah. So, you know, it's a great intellectual tradition which has made many important contributions. But, you know, if this is science, then science expands and mm-hmm. we learn new things and correct mistakes as we go on. So, you know, I'm definitely not saying that special interests don't play any role. But what I say is mostly they're involved in the details. So when you go and see that, you read the legislation on the steel tariff and notice there's one particular district that's getting extra money, that probably wasn't public opinion. That probably was some specific lobbyist in the steel industry who knew a very specific person who went and put that in. But on the other hand, the very fact that politicians will loudly announce that they have done something to help the steel industry, rather than keeping under wraps and in disguise, shows that they think, and probably correctly, the public will admire them mm-hmm. for helping the steel industry. Right. And this really is what politicians are about. And again, you know, like I think, you know, a lot of what I'm saying, you can see whenever there's an election when politicians seem to care an extra amount about public opinion. And what do they say? At least in the United States, they don't say we're going to stop wasting money on special interests. Instead, they say there's all of these great social programs that have been starved for funds. But on my watch, the starvation shall end. And at least at last, the people will have the health care they need and the education they need and on.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what happens during elections, and my story explains that, whereas the views of other economists who worked on politics before really doesn't account for that.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, two questions I think from this. Recommending that democracies do less and markets take up the slack to do more, mm-hmm. one, how do you sell that? Two, do you think there would be massive backlash? There would be massive backlash if voters were told, actually, no, we've had enough of you. It's time for the market mm-hmm. to take up the reins. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, those two questions, what do you think?
Right. So marketing is important.
Yeah.
Yes, marketing is very important. How you say things matters just as much or more than exactly what you say. So my view is here there's also division of labor, and most of the time I focus on just speaking very bluntly and clearly and then hoping that there is a master of marketing somewhere in the audience who will then figure out a way of selling what I have to say more effectively. But at the same time, I'm also going to add that I have spent a lot of time thinking about better marketing as well. I think honestly, a lot of the problem just comes down to being friendly, right? If you talk with a smile and a sense of humor and you are nice to people, you'd be amazed at what you can tell them and have them still not respond negatively. So I think that's very important. So probably here in the UK, everyone speaks very nicely to everyone else. But over in the United States, we have a very big problem with just bad attitudes. And I've spent quite a bit of time just trying to improve my own attitude, you say, well, your attitude's not that great. Well, it was worse in the past, but also, you know, just giving advice to others. So, you know, just, emphasizing the positive. And, you know, a lot of it is also just getting to the point, right? So I think a lot of economists lose listeners because they ramble on and just say too much and don't fast forward to the punchline, which, of course, for most people who are not experts, that's really what they care about. So, for example, the housing crisis and free market solutions to that, and I say, there really is a very simple solution. Let business build a lot more housing, mm-hmm. right? And then it will be cheap and abundant, mm-hmm. right? And so this is an idea where you could go and say that at the end of half-hour talk, or you could say it at the very beginning. Here is my solution to the housing crisis. Let business build much more housing. That way it will be abundant and then cheap. That's my solution, right? And all your complaints, overstated or wrong. Right. Right. So that's how I would approach it. But again, of course, just getting the right person with the right voice makes a very big difference. So in the United States, if you just go and listen to old speeches from Ronald Reagan, they're incredible speeches, but so much of it is not the content, but rather just the presentation and just the way that he sells himself as being a friendly next door neighbor rather than being an arrogant politician. And so I think that's very important as well. Of course, now, by the way, you can use all these techniques for evil too.
Yes.
So, that's just the truth, right? You can be Mr. Friendly Seller of Evil, right? And, of course, that's very, if someone comes along selling it, that's probably how they'll do it.
And could that not be an argument for more democracy as well, though? Because these people could actually utilize, as you've said, it could be used for evil. You know, if people have mm-hmm. this power that is unchecked mm-hmm. by the ballot box, mm-hmm. could they therefore use this power for evil in the end? Yeah.
So could they? Absolutely. Would they? That's an empirical question. I think there you really just have to go and compare, first of all, the opinions of experts in the public, but also of all their track record. So you want us to look at track record. I mean, really, I would say track record is the number one thing to look at, and opinions of secondary importance as a predictor of what future track records are going to be like. I would just say that the track record of, track record of experts overall is just quite a bit better. And again, especially the track record of experts in the Anglo-American world is, I think, especially good. So over in France, I would put less weight on their social scientists. And again, strikingly, of course, in a way, the French themselves do this because they send their best people over to Anglo-American universities. And not, of course, every single one, but very heavily. So I think this is, it's a sign of where the greatest minds go and learn more about the world and try to understand it is there is something, there is just something going on of higher quality in the Anglo-American intellectual world.
I think I speak for my whole generation when I say that a policy issue that you just raised is very, very pertinent and very pressing, which is the housing crisis. But voters have interests, right? Mm-hmm. Voters have an interest in ensuring that house prices are high because that ensures that the price, the value mm-hmm. of their home is high. I don't think they're inherently bad people for thinking that, but of course they vote with their mm-hmm. interests. I would quite like housing to not be 50% of my monthly salary, yes. which it is mm-hmm. in London.
Right, so that's a great, a great statement, because there's two things that are going, it's a very common view, but there's two things going on here. First of all, when we do public opinion of renters, we see that they also have the same attitudes of hostility to more construction.
Yeah.
So you don't.
Yeah.
Right now, I own a very expensive home in the U.S. and I favor new construction as well. All right. Now, so when you look at that, you say, okay, so it's not just a matter of self-interest, because the people who would clearly gain from more construction also are very suspicious of the construction industry. And then you step back and say, all right, so what really is the problem here? I think it is just a general suspicion of markets and just a willingness to go and latch on to even the flimsiest excuses for regulation. So, there'll be disruption of traffic during construction. Right? I suppose there will be, but how does that compare to the enormity of this problem? But then secondly, when you go and actually look at the interests of homeowners, it's much more complicated than just saying it is in homeowner's interest for price to stay high. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. Suppose that you own a home, it's worth £1 million, but you're in an area that is zoned only for single family housing. And then someone says, how about if we change the zoning so you can build a 100-story skyscraper here, and this will make the value of your home £5 million. That is a clear case where it would be very much in the homeowner's interest to go and allow for the deregulation, which will then ultimately, of course, reduce the price of an individual unit of housing, but still that homeowner will clean up in the process. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, similarly, of course, there's also many countries where there are strict limits on the share of the land that you can build anything on. So it's very common to say if you're going to build a skyscraper, then half the land must be wasted.
Yeah.
All right. And again, this is something where the homeowner would very much like to have that land rezoned so we can put the skyscraper up to the property line. Right. So that would be another example. And then, subdividing. So these are all areas actually where it would be in homeowners' interest to allow deregulation, yet they still generally don't want it. And again, I think this is not because they are there's some hidden wisdom that I haven't grasped. I think they're just wrong. And then, a last one that I actually think is highly relevant is, wouldn't you like your kids to be able to live in the same neighborhood? Mm-hmm. So, I would say, even if it would cut the price of the value of my property in half, I would think that would be great because I want my four kids to all live in my neighborhood. And I know they're going to be coming to me asking for help with a down payment if prices stay high. Whereas if you could just reduce property values in general, this would actually be to my long-run benefit. So again, just the way that people very rarely consider the way that homeowners actually are worse off as a result of the status quo, and the way that people are so quick to say, well, of course, the status quo is in their interest. It's not that obvious, actually. It's really complicated. And I think a lot of what economics has to say and what social science has to say is that social issues are much more complicated than what people think. And I mean, a lot of that, of course, is because people don't think at all about social questions. They feel, they emote.
I mean, that again, that comes down to a marketing issue, surely, doesn't it? A marketing issue for why it is in your interest, et cetera, et cetera, which we're not hearing.
Right, although even there, as to whether you want to market it as it's in your interest, I mean, I think a lot of times you want to say it's in the best interest of society and yours as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, like one of the most interesting things about public opinion is that, in general, self-interest is a very poor predictor of what an individual thinks.
Right.
Normally, rather, it is high ideals that seem to drive people's views about what ought to be done politically. And, you know, it's not, and you might think, isn't that just a mask for underlying self-interest? It just doesn't seem to be so. So, I mean, here in London, I bet you have a whole lot of wealthy Labour voters, right? And so what do they think is in it for them? You can come up with some kind of conspiracy theory, but I think really it's that they believe that this is what's best for the country and they're willing to go and sacrifice for that. And so, of course, you know, I think the best sales pitch of all is to say that everything can be great with no sacrifice at all, right? And if you can honestly say that, and I think you often honestly can, then best of all. But if you do have to choose between either marketing to people's idealism or their self-interest, I would actually say I would go to, I would appeal to idealism.
As we approach 2020, I wonder if we can have this question to bring the podcast to a close. But as we approach 2020, and we think about the last decade, it's been pretty good for the world. You know, we've seen economic growth and child poverty mortality rates drop. I think it's something like 70% of the growth the world has experienced over the past, has been created over the past decade, rather. And that is an amazing statistic. You know, we have got a lot as humans to be pretty optimistic and happy about. Yet still, if I was to go out there right on that street there and grab a few random people and ask them whether or not they think poverty has fallen, I can pretty much guarantee the answer would be no, it hasn't. It's gone up, whether that be in the United Kingdom or globally. So how then would you like to see the debate change? Do you think those of us who do advocate free markets have just been, again, going back to that marketing problem? It's our fault. We're just not very good at selling this optimistic message when the product is so good. Or is it a case of, actually, no, you know, this will never work. Voters are the problem. And that's where we are.
Right. So here's what I would say. The constructive view is always to blame yourself. It's always more fruitful to say, I'm doing something wrong. What could I do to do better? However, that's not actually the truth. And some things are just hard. So there are some things that are much harder to sell than other things. It's much harder to sell people on the idea that, for example, a very mundane example, you know, much harder to tell someone that they're sick and there's nothing that medical science can do for them and they're best off just trying to control the pain and die, rather than to go and say, I have many experimental treatments that we can try. Right. And if you had to sell one of those two messages, the second one is a much more saleable message than the first one, even though the first one sometimes is the most honest one. So in any case, you know, this means that on the one hand, you know, you shouldn't be miserable because and say I'm complete failure because I haven't changed everyone's minds. At the same time, though, it is much more fruitful to think, well, what can I try? How can I try to do things better and more effectively? Right. And now, especially among economists, I think a lot of their problem is just not getting to the point and boring people, right? You know, there is the stereotype of the boring economist going all the way back at the, you know, probably much before then, but most famously in the U.S., there's the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where there's the very boring economics teacher played by Ben Stein, right? And, you know, and there's a lot of economists who are boring like that. And I try to go and tell people, you know, stop being boring, you know, be more fun, be more exciting. Right. And you know, well, of course, trying to change someone who's, you know, 60 years old and say, OK, now's the day you're not going to be boring anymore. That's really tough. But trying to get young people who have better personalities into social science, I think that's worth doing. And but also, you know, that's an age when there's just a lot more opportunity to go and mold people and improve the way they're thinking. And I think the things like podcasting and the Internet generally have improved the communication skills of the younger generation of social scientists. So, I mean, it is learnable, it is teachable, but hard. Mm-hmm. So you can either then give up or you can redouble your efforts. So since I'm in this profession, I've tried to just try harder. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a message to us all, I think, and an optimistic note to end the podcast on. Thank you very much for joining the IEA today.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you can look forward to me putting out the poverty talk later on this month, I would hope. Now, you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And for more films, blogs, and reports, go to our website, iea.org.uk.